Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China. I'm your host, Kaiser Guo. Today on Seneca, we're going to devote the entire show to China's environment. Joining me as co-host is Will Moss, the man behind ImageThief.com. How are you, Will?
Hi, Kaiser.
We're very pleased today to welcome two guests who, unlike my fellow host and me, know a great deal about the environment in China. Alex Wong is joining us for the first time on Seneca. He's senior attorney and director of the China Environmental Law Project at the Natural Resources Defense Council here in Beijing. How are you, big guy?
Good. Thanks for having me here.
Joining us again on Seneca, we've got Jonathan Watts, Asia Environment Correspondent for The Guardian, who has just published a great new book called When a Billion Chinese Jump, How China Will Save Mankind or Destroy It. Welcome back, John.
Good to be here. Thanks, guys.
So like I said, today the entire hour or whatever is devoted to the environment, and we'll be talking quite a bit about John's book. So let's jump right in and talk about your book. I mean, one of the things that I thought was really striking about it was the structure of it itself, which is, I think, a terrific approach. You divided it into sections titled in order Nature, Man, Imbalance, and Alternatives, each looking at a specific geographic region and a set of environmental issues. What was the thinking behind this?
Well, the idea was to try and write an environment book that was accessible. A lot of environment books are not, partly because they tend to be very dry and top-down. I wanted to do something from the bottom up, and so I tried to look at the problems of China's environment in terms of the geography. And as a result, I split it into four parts. It starts off with the Southwest and the ecological wealth that we are leaving behind, what we're losing in a sense. So it's a chapter on forests, a chapter on mountains, a chapter on rivers, and a chapter on wildlife.
The nature section, right?
That's the nature section.
You also sort of use that section to set up this sort of Taoist idea, this sort of Taoistic idea against which you juxtapose, for lack of a better word, kind of a more technocratic Confucian idea that seems to be more pervasive in today's China.
Absolutely. It's you could call it backward-looking in a way. It looks at the sort of the beliefs that human beings have lived by for a very long time and that have sustained people for in various communities for a long time. So there is Taoism. There are Bon beliefs. There are a number of other indigenous and minority beliefs that are discussed in this area.
Bon being the sort of animist shamanistic tradition that sort of predates Tibetan Buddhism, right?
Indeed, and it's still widely practiced amongst the Nashi people in Yunnan.
I was once accused of being a neo-Nashi. I'm sorry.
I haven't seen you in the clothes. I'm curious, you know, when you read the book, it comes across as a very personal narrative. It comes across as that travelogue from your point of view. And the idea of approaching it that way and researching it with that in mind, did that change your experience of on these travels or change how you perceived things as you went through China?
Well, it's a mixture of two things. I mean, part of the book is based on journeys I've done over the last 7 years, even before I planned to write a book. But another big chunk of the book, more than half of it, is based on specific journeys that I undertook when I knew I would be doing this. And I guess that slightly changes your perceptions.
Let's be clear here. This is not a travel book. In fact, I highly recommend that one does not use this in lieu of, say, The Lonely Planet in planning a trip this summer. You'll commit suicide.
It might be useful as a guide to all the places you don't want to go. Rule those out.
This depends on what excites you.
Right.
Yeah. And actually, to be
the Schadenfreude tour.
One of the purposes of those early chapters was, though, to show that there are still a lot of exceptionally beautiful places in China. And I think a lot of people in the outside world, they look a lot at the smokestack side of things. They don't know about Zhoujai Gou. They don't know about the Tibetan Plateau, and they don't see images well enough. So it was kind of to set an eco-inventory of the incredible ecological wealth that China does have left.
Alex, one of the things that I really liked about John's book, I mean, we want to get back into the Compass Point itinerary, but I think let's use that actually to walk through a lot of John's book. But one of the things that I thought was great about this, and John, I mean, you jump right in if you think that I'm wrong, is that you keep coming back to this effort to be fair. In fact, you drew some criticism from Jonathan Mirsky, who was another former China-based reporter and not known to be, you know, to pull his punches when he writes. But in a generally favorable review, he talked about your book as having sort of this bizarre effort at fairness. But Alex, I was really impressed with the way that he kept sort of making the reader empathetic with the conundrum in which Chinese people find themselves, you know, wanting on the one hand to enjoy the same fruits of the developed modern world that the Westerners have enjoyed for many, many, many decades, but realizing the environmental costs. This is something that must just be a perennial theme in your work.
Right. I think that's an important point to keep in mind because, you know, when you travel around China, you realize that China is still a very poor country. You know, people are striving, trying to get by, trying to improve their lives. And I think you need to remember that some of the types of things that are happening in China happened in the U.S., happened in England, happened in other parts of the country, you know, of the world. And, you know, they're happening now in China. The difference in China is that it's bigger, it's faster, and it's more global than you've ever seen before. I think Jonathan is really highlighting the fact that this is in some ways like what you've seen before, but in some ways like nothing you've ever seen. So it's both something that you might feel is a little bit familiar, maybe we can see an end, you know, light at the end of the tunnel, but it's also something that's completely unknown.
Yeah, this was sort of the key theme, I think, at Copenhagen, right? This idea that, look, you guys have been pigging out at the trough for all this time. I think we were just talking earlier about one metaphor that was floating around. It's sort of a complicated one. I'll try to make it simple. But it's, you know, China is a malnourished man who's just joined a banquet where there are a bunch of men suffering the diseases of the rich, obesity, gout, diabetes, and things like that. And then suddenly being told, don't eat any meat. You should maintain a vegetarian diet. Stay off the milk products. And by the way, when the bill comes due, you're paying your share too. You know, you were there. Actually, Jonathan, both of you were at Copenhagen. Yeah. I think, Will, it's fair to say a lot of us here who are in Beijing watching this, we couldn't get a really clear sense of what really happened. And I've been dying to hear.
I think it's very, very hard if you're a distant observer to get any real feel of how those discussions played out and what of actual meaning came out of it, with all due respect to the observers and the journalists who were there.
Right. You know, you had that Mark Linus piece in The Guardian, right, which was basically laying the blame squarely at Beijing's feet. Somehow they didn't sit right with me. Can you guys, you know, break this down for me?
Well, you know, I think it's fair to say China got hammered after Copenhagen for, you know, the Mark Linus piece basically said it was China's fault for a lack of success. I think that that viewpoint was unfair. I mean, Copenhagen did not come to a solution, and it was not just China's fault. The major countries did not come together and come to a solution. So I think that it's unfair to just say it's China's fault. You know, right now the U.S. is struggling to get an energy bill through. You know, that needs to happen. The U.S. needs to move first. Yeah.
When you look at all the issues that Jonathan chronicles in the book and all the battles of perception and different points of view that Kaiser talked about, is there any multilateral solution? Is there any hope of any kind of common point of view on that to either of you guys?
I think that is the really big question, and the greatest effort at finding that multilateral solution so far was Copenhagen, and that's why there was this incredible sense of disappointment when the outcome was far, far short of what everyone had hoped for. And I think because of that disappointment, that's why there was such a blame game. I don't want to hold this. I don't want to be responsible. I don't want to be called the one who put the world down the plug hole in the end. But I agree completely. To say this is only China's fault is certainly not fair. China has a share of the blame and a growing share of the blame, to be sure. But no single country is responsible. And I think one of the reasons Mirsky may not have liked the story, the book that I wrote. That's true.
I think overall it was positive.
Yeah. But that comment that I went to bizarre lengths to be fair is Mirsky tends to like things in black and white, and the book very much paints a picture that China's problem at the moment is too much gray. And, you know, the gray skies, the gray governance policies where it's hard to know who's running what, all those sorts of things. And in the course of writing the book, my views towards China's environment changed a lot. I started out thinking, a book about China's environment, I'm going to be writing about pollution. I'll be writing about climate change. I'll be writing about a communist government that doesn't allow enough transparency and accountability, and that these are the China-specific problems. What you find, though, after you look at it, exactly as Alex said, it's a global problem. This is the culmination of 200-odd years of development, and China's really unfortunate. The really unfortunate thing about China right now is its timing. It's rising just as we kind of hit this ecological wall.
Were there particular things that changed your thinking about that, that you encountered as you were putting the book together?
In a sense, it was not a particular thing. I mean, it was the process of writing a book. When you're a journalist, you jump from story to story. You become more knowledgeable about certain stories rather than other stories. But when you write a book, you really engross yourself in something. It allows you to make connections you didn't make before, to put things in a historical context, a geographical context. And when you do that, I think that's when you realize that one of the reasons perhaps that Copenhagen didn't work is it was trying to achieve so much. I think coming from a British point of view was also, I realized, an advantage. I think Britain kind of started this whole process off 200-odd years ago.
That's right.
I saw you draw that circle.
And now China's right at the other end. The bookends.
Our whole period of carbon consumption.
Yeah. Right. And we're trying to get away from that. But
You should solve the problem then.
We'll work it out during this session. We've still got a couple of minutes left.
On the general tone of fairness, I think it would be very easy. It is very easy. I think lesser people might have just spent the entire time just sneering at this mad rush of the Han Chinese to this sort of technocratic future, but Han materialism comes in for a beating only appropriately. You save the sneering for the chapter on Shanghai, which is totally appropriate because the chapter that you titled "Conspicuous Consumption." Can we actually continue our little journey around? We started in the Southwest with Shangri-La, where you talk actually very interestingly about Joseph Rock, who was the American botanist who was carried around in a bathtub, I believe, at some point as he made his way through the Yungwe Plateau. You talk about Francis Young's husband. I thought that was some terrific stuff. So from the nature setup in the Southwest, where do you go?
Then I go to what we've replaced, what we're replacing nature with, or the processes by which we're changing the world, or by which China's changing in particular. So then I moved to the Southeast and the most economically vibrant area in many ways, and look at globalization, urbanization, industrialization, and the Shanghai chapter about consumer culture.
Right. And there's some really disturbing parts in there about the recycling of electronic waste. I mean, that was it's a story that's been covered before, but this was a particularly graphic and brutal portrayal of what's happening in cities in Zhejiang mainly, right?
It's mainly in Guangdong, actually.
Oh, that's in Guangdong, actually.
They're all along the coast, but sure, Guangdong is perhaps the most well-known one. Yeah, and it's quite shocking when you go to a little village in the middle of Guangdong and palm trees all around, not a white face in sight, and yet there's just the detritus of a typical British high street that I grew up in, scattered all over the riverbanks and the floors, and baled up by factories, and there's Kellogg's packets and Persil washing up liquid packets and chocolate bar packets. And you think, how did this get here?
You had this whole Yiwu section, and then that terrific piece about Huaxi, the number one village in China. Wow, that was where did you find this stuff? I mean, we all know about Yiwu. We know about cities like Wuxi. We know about places where they make all the lampshades or all the fasteners and stuff. But Huaxi was fascinating. I mean, that place, it's sort of the spirit of the Great Leap Forward in a lot of ways. These smelters and this heavy industry in a completely rural area.
This place is amazing. I recommend anybody.
So we to do go put there. That actually on the tourist
list. That would be on the tourist list.
That was one of the parts of the book that I didn't get to yet, since I've been speed reading it over the last 2 days. But explain a little bit about it.
Well Huaxi is was a regular village in Jiangsu province, and it had a particularly bold leader who was determined to make a lot of money, even during the Mao era, and suffered for it. His youngest son, I think, was paralyzed. He was so badly beaten at one point. He didn't give up, and initially, secretly, he started a factory. And then that was even before 1980, 1982, gradually built this one factory into a conglomeration, gradually expanding all the time and sucking in all the villagers and promising them to be rich if they followed his rules to the letter. And they did. And they became very, very rich on paper. And so I was picked up at the airport in a stretch limo. This is 6 years ago in Jiangsu.
There's something that doesn't happen to journalists in China all the time. Foreign journalists in China.
I've been bought off. How can you say
you
no?
You know how it is for me now, traveling with my
band. But it
doesn't
happen to NGO people in China all that often.
Not too often.
I should say, I mean, it was amazing when I went there. And I found out this year that to celebrate one of their anniversaries, I can't exactly remember what it is, they're planning to build a skyscraper bigger than the Empire State Building
in
a village in Jiangsu. It's just incredible.
My lord. I have seen some really bizarre places in Jiangsu. For example, this city that actually you mentioned among this list of 100 some odd cities of more than a million people that people have never heard of, Suchen in northern Jiangsu province, another one of these sort of if you build it, they will come insta cities with a party secretary who is now in charge of Kunming, I believe. He's been really promoted to the ranks. This guy by the name of Chou He, fascinating character. Mm. Anyway, I don't want to digress. But for your next book, we shouldn't leave actually the Southwest without mention of Chapter 4, and probably the most heartbreaking chapter in here. Alex, I don't know if you got a chance to read that one.
I haven't had a chance to look at it.
About the Yangtze River dolphin, mm-hmm. the Baiji.
I thought that was a devastating chapter.
Mm-hmm. The Baiji twin, yeah, that was absolutely. You actually were on the expedition that actually has been written about quite a bit, in which they failed to find in 2006 a Baiji. What was that like? I mean, you do convey it pretty well, but for our listeners, tell us about what you were going through as you realized that it looks like this species is functionally extinct.
It was a real a turning point for me in terms of looking at the environment, in terms of a lot of things. Mainly because I went off on this expedition in hunt of the Baiji dolphin on the Yangtze thinking, just another story. There are so many endangered species. Here's another one. We go and look for it. It would be interesting. But didn't really look at the long-term consequences, the implications. And we set off it was Hollywood style. It had everything the modern world has to offer. There was a big corporate sponsor. There was an array of potential heroes, all the best marine biologists in the world. There were the best ships that money could buy. That had the full backing of the Chinese government. And it seemed like, you know, it's the world's A-team going to save this dolphin at last. And yet within 2 days, they hadn't found any on the area, on the stretch of the Yangtze where you were most likely to see them. And this sense of hope and possibility quickly faded into a whodunit. Who's responsible for this? And by the end of of this very long expedition, it wasn't on the whole expedition, the Baiji was declared functionally extinct. Mm-hmm. And when I went to write the story, and you do a bit more background research, and you start to think, this is a dolphin that's been around for 20 million years. And I'm writing an obituary, in a sense, one of many people writing an obituary. And how many times do you get to write a story with a time frame of 20 million years coming to a full stop? That was a shock. And it was also a shock that I think many of us, certainly me, when we look at environment problems, we think, eventually it will get solved. Human beings are smart. We'll throw money at it. We'll throw brains at it. We'll work it out. But sometimes it's too late. And that sense of sometimes it's too late really stuck with me since that time.
That was a very, very powerful part, in at least what I've read in the book so far. And I want to actually use that to bring us back around to Alex for a moment, who's been quiet for the last couple of minutes. But before I do, I'm curious, from what I've read so far, there's all of these very powerful vignettes, you know, that form different parts of your story. And when you think back on them, what are the things that had the biggest, made the biggest impression on you or that stayed with you?
This has got to be one of them.
This would definitely be one of them, which probably makes me seem heartless that I remember a dolphin the most. But I mean, there are so many. I mean, eco-refugees who are forced from their home because of desertification.
I mean, good God, you went to AIDS villages, cancer villages.
There are a lot of heartbreaking stories that are related to the environment, some of them. And, there's a very long list of these kind of small individual stories of people affected.
But you can draw a line straight from that story to the climate issue that we were just talking about. You know, we're talking about with climate, you know, I think you addressed the issue fairly and talked about, well, you know, trying not to blame any particular person. But regardless of whether you blame someone, the problem is happening. It's getting larger, right? So in some ways, you know, you look at the Baiji dolphin situation. Well, you know, people tried and they didn't end up, saving the species. Well, with climate, you know, people are talking about, well, what's coming down the pike in a few decades? And, you know, everyone's struggling to deal with it. Everyone's trying not to blame, other people and talking about what you should do about it, but action's not happening.
So there's another way in which this ties to what we were talking about earlier with climate change. And I think that it's the fact of history, the fact of, you know, that we're entering into this phase of consciousness at very different periods in our history. John, at one point in your book, you talk about how when the United States began protecting nature around the turn of the 20th century, its population density was 10 people to a square kilometer. And when China started, its population was squeezed 145, that's what, 14 and a half times as many, to the same area. There was not much room left for other forms of life. In this chapter that you write on the eating of species, you make another reference to the fact that, like, up until the 1990s, actually, probably they actually at the Beijing Zoo, and I remember this, they said what parts of the animal were actually good to eat or were had medicinal value in them. This is maybe a theme that's in absolutely everything, every issue between China and the West. But isn't there something to be said for history, for an exemptionist claim to be made because China is so much later to this? I mean, this is something that's in your book a few times, but Alex, this ties in with, you know, Copenhagen and everything, doesn't it?
By exemptionist claim, do you mean that sort of like, because China's coming, you know, China should have their chance to,
right,
to do this,
the
to do what we did.
Historical responsibility thing. It's
you know, I think, you know, that is an issue that is debated a lot, and I think in trying to be fair to China, I think there's no doubt that it's hard. I think the thing that you can't do as an American or as a European is to look at what's going on in China with a sense of, I can't believe that's happening because we already did it.
Right.
Okay, that's a little strange to say that. But then again, you know, the problem is so massive, particularly in the climate situation, that just saying that, well, they should have their chance is not
that's
a good enough answer
problem,
because
right. –
Because we're all gonna,
we're all gonna
be dead if we, you know, if we take that attitude. So I mean, ultimately, something has to get done, and we have to work together to figure that out.
I mean, as always, I'm interested in what's actually going to work in terms of international policy. I mean, browbeating just doesn't seem to work. I mean, I've seen so many of my Chinese friends who would, I think, otherwise have, you know, considerable sympathies for the environmental movement, sort of circle up the wagons and feel like, you know, we're under attack now. You're using this as yet another club to beat on China and in an unfair way. Are we going about it wrong? I mean, just simply, you know, the screeching at China over its environmental irresponsibility?
Well, this is an interesting discussion because we're going from kind of ground level on rivers in China all the way to the kind of international UN level.
Yeah, but that's where the decisions ultimately get taken.
I think the result of Copenhagen put into question whether this UN kind of requirement of unanimous consent to come to an agreement, that whether that system is going to work, because a few countries at Copenhagen kind of blocked a deal. But I think our view of Copenhagen is that it led to more countries than ever before coming together around the climate issue, making commitments. One thing that Jonathan talks about a lot in his book is about governance in China, mm-hmm. and how that's an issue for, you know, how can you actually control and regulate and stop the things that are happening that he talks about in his book. And I think there have been some, you know, there's still a long way to go in China on that, but there have been some really interesting things going on in the last few years. Last 5 years, for the first time, China made energy and environment targets a national high-level plan target, and they've been gearing up to do a series of programs to try to get that under control. So I think there's some interesting things going on. And then also, you also talk about the kind of bottom up, a lot of NGOs, a lot of people that we work with, you know, great people working on the ground level. That's the kind of other side of it. You need these great, passionate people who will commit their lives to these issues to raise attention and bring, you know, bring attention to the issue and do something about the problem.
Well, I mean, if we were to keep going on the structure of the book, we've kind of moved into that third section.
Sure.
Of the Northwest, which really looks at where the strains of the current model are starting to show. You know, the air,
the Malthusian crisis.
The Malthusian crisis, the air quality crisis, the water shortage crisis, the climate change crisis.
Yeah, desertification.
Desertification. It looks at all of those issues, and it really tries to connect what's happening with the individual, say, the Kazakh herder underneath the melting glacier, with exactly what's going on at the top level in the negotiating halls of Copenhagen and beyond. And I think, going back to your question, Kaiser, there is this issue of fairness. It just runs through everything. And if we are to be completely fair, we would be completely screwed.
That's right.
I think China will realize that before anyone else, because in a sense, it's got the most to lose. This is a place with so many glaciers. It's got cities like Urumqi that are really dependent on glacier meltwater. It's a place where desertification is eating into cropland. I mean, you can go on and on. The storms we see, we just had the hottest day in Beijing for, what is it, 30, 40, 50 years.
Not long enough for me.
I mean, this is a place where I think the policymakers realize you can't go on. It's no point being fair. Britain, the U.S., other countries, in a sense, they didn't know what they were doing for a very, very long time. And knowledge is one element in how guilty you are, I think, according to sort of Platonic views. Mm-hmm. Was it Platonic? Anyway, according to one view of the law. So the lawyer, not me.
But to keep ugly politics in the mix, you know, even in the U.S., particularly in the U.S., we can't come to any consensus about this at a political level. So that makes it pretty hard to establish an example for anybody else, certainly for China.
Well, I mean, that's actually a big difference right now. You know, China actually has energy intensity reduction targets, a climate target. U.S. is still struggling to get the energy bill passed. So China, actually, you know, we're daily at meetings with officials, academics, trying to figure out actually ways to implement that policy. In the U.S., we're struggling to convince people to pass the laws and policies. So
what about the grassroots? What about, you know, among, you know, your ordinary Chinese city dwellers? Do you sense that environmental conscientiousness is on the rise in a meaningful way, or is it sort of bumper sticker T-shirt style commitment?
No, but I mean, it's easy to sneer at bumper stickers
eco-friendly
food. I do it all the time. I do it in the book, but it's a start. It's a start, and I think actually, public opinion in China has moved beyond that in a lot of places. I've been here 7 years now, and I've noticed a huge change in the number of NGOs, green NGOs, in the number of media stories about the environment, in as Alex was saying, at the top level, in the number of government policy papers, all of this sort of stuff. But again, it goes back to the question you raised before about, is browbeating China the way to go, or is there another approach? And I think persuasion has to be the way to do it at this grassroots level. Your values, you can have better values than those of the US at the moment, those of Britain at the moment. You can actually come out of this looking better, living healthier lives in many ways.
And there have been some really interesting cases all around the country. It's sort of communities taking to the streets over a chemical factory that's going to be built
Absolutely.
In their community, or a transmission line that's built 5 feet away from your apartment building, or things like that. And that they've been cropping up on a regular basis. You cite one of the statistics on mass incidents and disputes over environment.
And
that's been rising,
rising
year on year, kind of the disputes over environmental issues.
There very much seem to be two halves to that issue. On the one hand, there's this sort of rising public consciousness about these issues and an increasing willingness to speak out when people feel like they're, you know, they're getting the short end of the environmental mm-hmm. stick. At the same time, Jonathan, you talk a lot about the growth in consumption here, the increasing use of domestic appliances, the continuing rip-roaring sales of automobiles, and these things seem to be in conflict with each other.
Well, I think when you look at China and China's environment, you can see it as entirely black. You can see it as very green. You can be plunged into despair, or you can see hope for everyone. I mean, hence the rather awkward subtitle of the book, Will China Save Mankind or Destroy It? But you do get this feeling of these two extremes, and China's so big, they're both true. But overall, I would say the trend towards more consumption, higher emissions, is the dominant one. There are a lot of good things going on, and they're often not recognized in the outside world. But the overall trend is China's going the same path that all mm-hmm. of the rest of us have gone on.
To hell in a handbasket.
So can I ask you an uncomfortable question?
Mm. I think you're going to do that.
Do you? Yes, I am. Because as a PR man, to ask journalists uncomfortable questions is what I live for. But you can cut that part out, guys.
I'm now a PR man, too.
Yeah, the subtitle of the book, How China Will Save Mankind or Save the Planet or Destroy It. I forget the exact wording. You personally, where do you put your money on those two equations? Is it going to save the world or destroy the world?
In the conclusion, I of course fudge this. I mean, but basically, what I think we are moving towards, certainly not a destroyed planet. We'll be gone. The planet will still be here. Mm-hmm. It's not the planet. It's mankind that's at risk. I think we are in jeopardy. How long it's going to take for that to manifest itself is an open question. We're at great risk. The responsibility of the billion Chinese jumping is partial. We cannot forget a billion people in the rich world have already jumped even further.
That's right. They jumped a whole bunch of times.
So you can, and perhaps, you know, if you could dream of what China could do, it would be that China says, okay, we realize we're going in a wrong direction. We have a lot of momentum on our side. We will pioneer a genuinely new way of finding energy. I mean, the search for energy we haven't really discussed. This is mm-hmm. this is a huge issue. It's not the only one. Mm-hmm. I think that the two keys are the supply side search for new energy through technology, renewable energy. And the other side of it is a demand side reduction in consumption. And China's doing an awful lot on the first side at the moment. That's the whole thrust of scientific development. It's not doing very much at all on the second side. And that's where you've really got to win people over. You cannot just lecture them, you've got to persuade them. And at the moment, I'm pessimistic because we haven't really worked it out in the West.
Yeah, it's also a false question to ask, will China save the world or destroy it? Because right now, the developed world is so intertwined with China. You know, one study that came out a few years ago said a third of the emissions in China come from products made for export to the developed world.
That's right.
Right. So we've moved our manufacturing over here. We're still buying all the cheap products, benefiting from that.
We're
emissions
sending out
are
recycling
come here, right? So it's not China. It's all of us. And the consumption issue that we're discussing here is a critical one that a lot of people don't really like to talk about because it means changing your lifestyle. Means doing things differently than we do now. We kind of like the air conditioning, we like the dishwasher, we like the dryer and things like that. And that one, you know, we kind of have to all look in the mirror and say, well, we need to change something. You know, there are going to be technological fixes, but that's not going to be the
John, I think, said it really beautifully, and I highlighted this. Having visited almost every province in the country, I am far more concerned about Shanghai's friendly shoppers than Hunan's snarling polluters. The latter are a recognized problem that can be cleared up with sufficient time, money, and government effort. The former, however, are hailed as potential saviors of the global economy. That really struck home with me.
It lays out the dilemma, doesn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely does. It absolutely does. There was another passage that you wrote which for some reason really resonated with me. It was just very visual. You sort of anthropomorphized the earth and talked about its skin, its hair, its veins.
You're a big hippie.
I don't have the beard anymore.
No, you don't have the beard. You've shaved. But no, can you repeat that? It was I don't have it written down here in front of me, unfortunately. But Can you find that passage? You got it in front of you there?
It just so happens I do. Our planet, too, seems to be aging. On the road, I've seen how the Earth's lungs, the forests, have been decimated. Its skin, the soil, is getting drier and more reliant on chemicals. The pressure on the Earth's arteries, the rivers, are higher owing to blocking dams and clogging pollution. Our energy reserves, coal and oil, are being run down faster than ever. Temperatures are less predictable, and there are more and more unhealthy growths in lakes and oceans. Many nations show some of these symptoms, but they are all apparent in China, where the impacts of development are accumulated, amplified, and accelerated.
Wow, that's really, really well said. I cannot recommend this book more highly. Seriously, I think that it's, well, first of all, it's incredibly readable, and it's very personal. I went through, read the entire thing practically in just 2 days, and that was just on commutes, you know, to and from Baidu. Listen, there's one question I want to close with, and I think this is probably the one that I want to put to all three of you here. A few years back, I was asked to take part in a little get-together of young folks. I was young back then, with Gerd Leipold from Greenpeace, who was in town visiting. And this was the question that he asked us, and everyone had different answers. Some reminded me of what Jonathan was talking about in his book in the early chapters. Some of these guys said that needs to be a sort of a revival of the Taoist idea of harmony with nature, of actual subordination of man to nature. Everyone had all these different ideas. Mine, it seems sort of callow now in retrospect. What I suggested was that urban youth, and this is the specific target, and this is, you know, how do we get urban youth? I said they're not going to, you know, a neo-Taoism isn't necessarily going to resonate, but making it cool, making environmentalism just incredibly, you know, fashionable and cool, as I think it has been done in the West, seems like a way to go. How would you boost environmental consciousness? I never know which word to use among young people in Chinese cities today. What's the way to do it?
John,
gosh. Go first.
I think that there is an effort already underway, and I do explore this in the latter part of the book. There are a lot of NGOs working on this. They are trying to recruit the people that young consumers look to, the pop stars, the celebrities. That seems crass. We all look at it and think, oh, no, not another Bono in China or whatever. But it does get the message across. They are great communicators, people like that. But I think that more and more, I think the way forward is not just to concentrate on young people. I think the key for me is to reconnect the environment and the economy. They become detached. Somehow we need to make values for the economy connect to values.
What happened to green GDP? What happened to
exactly that? Right, got shot down completely.
Yeah, that's really unfortunate. I mean, because they realized that it was negative growth when you factored it all in. Right?
Exactly.
That's actually in your book. Right. Alex, what about you? What's your recommendation if you're sitting down with Gerd?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, in China right now, environmental issues are so immediate in your face that you can't sort of avoid the issue. I think it's already making a lot of people say, well, you know, I think, you know, it's nice to develop and it's nice to have nice things, but what's the point if I'm afraid to go outside and breathe the air? So I think, you know, you already are seeing a lot of people having a sort of change in mindset. But I think Jonathan's absolutely right on this sort of development versus environment. Too many people still make an excuse for not doing anything about the environment. You know, there's still, when we go around the country, that you sort of hear that as the reason. Well, you know, China's not quite ready to.
Well, we were like addicts. We need to hit rock bottom.
You know, maybe a few years from now. You know, it's always a few years down the road.
America needed to have its environmental come to Jesus moment in order to make serious progress and make serious regulatory progress.
What, the oil shocks of the 70s?
Well, the oil shocks, the what was it, the Cuyahoga River catching on
Cuyahoga
fire.
River catching on fire.
The Silent Spring.
Know, like, right.
Really serious.
Maybe the BP spill will be another major shock.
It has the makings of one.
Yeah. So I think, you know, the things that are going on now are raising people's consciousness already. And I think, you know, it's becoming a bit of a fashion, kind of, you know, the word low carbon is, you know, people's grandmothers are talking about low carbon now. So I think the PR on low carbon has worked, but I think that needs to get pushed further. And you know, we've talked about a lot of the problems today, but I think obviously the next thing is talking about solutions. And
my wife's telling me about low carbs.
With good reason.
Yes.
But you know, there are a lot of things that we can do to be more efficient, to, you know, that don't involve kind of going back to, you know, caveman times.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
You know, we can have good quality of life and also do better for the environment.
As long as I can keep my iPad.
I don't want to tread on the experts with my own opinions about how to fix the problem.
Oh, but it's never stopped you.
But can I ask one final question?
Absolutely.
Please. Which is, I'd be interested in hearing from each of you guys, especially with regards to China, because that's what we're really talking about here. What gives you hope?
A number of things. I think, one, the crisis gives me hope. This is a place where you can't ignore the problems. A lot of countries are so rich that people live almost climate-controlled lives, and they read about the problems, but they don't feel them. And here,
it's in your face.
Half the population absolutely feel it all the time. So I think, one, people can't ignore it as easily as other places. Yes, people still try to do that. And the other is, there are just an amazing number of people involved in NGOs who are doing great work. There are some scientists, we haven't really discussed this, but the whole scientific approach, there's a great deal of money and intelligence going into that at the moment, and there's brilliant stuff going on in that side of things.
So technocracy doomed China.
Technocracy could save China. Is part of the solution. I think there's a bit too much overemphasis on that, but certainly that shouldn't be ignored.
For me, I think it's the people. You know, I work with a lot of people from, you know, including NGOs, including academics, also a lot of people in government as well, who are really against all odds and with really no reason that they really should be focused on doing these things, they are really putting a lot into trying to solve this problem. I think it's really inspiring to me to meet these people, and I think, you know, that's the key, that gives me hope.
Alex Wong from the Natural Resources Defense Council, Jonathan Watts, environment correspondent for The Guardian, and Will Moss, the Man Behind Imagery. Thanks very much for joining me today, and I'll see you guys next week on the Seneca Podcast. Take care.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.